May it please the Court, Kenneth W. Starr for Braun Medical, and I will do my best to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. In this diversity case involving a very important medical device, there's several points that we think are vital to the appeal.
Mr. Starr, before you get to the merits of the case, or lack of merits of the case, let me ask you a foundation question as to whether or not this Court has appellate jurisdiction, or if we don't, do we have to dismiss the case? There was a remittiture order entered into. That order was never accepted or rejected. If it were accepted, of course, your friend across the aisle could not appeal. You could, but they couldn't. If it were rejected, the only thing the appellee could have done was to retry the case. Given that scenario, don't we have before us an interlocutory appeal, which is not sanctioned under 1291?
Only, Judge Cowan, to the extent of the remittiture. At a post-trial motion adjudication, the Court did indeed, as you say, and my brothers on the other side disagree, but I think that the Court did in fact grant a remittiture. The Court used the word remit. The Court engaged in a remittiture type exercise that we're very familiar with. It also then said in its bottom line that the motion for remittiture, Braun's motion for remittiture, is granted in part. However, the Court did enter final judgment with respect to the assignment of the 451 patent, which is fundamentally, of course, why we brought our declaratory judgment action to begin with. There is a final judgment there, but I agree that my brother, or I shouldn't say I agree, I would propose that my brother, were this case to be returned, and that is our fundamental submission today, that for a variety of reasons, the case should go back to Judge Brewster, and if I could, there Mr. Rogers has to make that determination. Does he accept that remittiture, or does he go for a new trial? We believe, may it please the Court, that a new trial is necessary for a variety of grounds.
But let me stop there. Let's play this out. If he accepts a new trial, what does that do to the equitable action, the equitable determination and findings by the Court with respect to the assignment of patent? In other words, if we say that the district court erred in not affording that option on a remittiture, what does that do to what you've called the caboose of this?
For separate reasons, I believe the caboose trial has to go back as well.
And right. I just wanted, but taking it one step at a time.
Yes.
If we were to reverse on the remittiture, what does that do to the court's equitable findings?
I think that the entire case has to go back if he opts for a new trial under remittiture practice. That's his judgment. But I would also guide the Court and urge the Court to consider, as I know the Court will, our caboose trial arguments. Namely, that was a jury trial. There's something that's very foundationally missing here, which is the jury. It was the jury that should have heard the evidence with respect to the relationships between three entities, Rogers, Braun, and then VIR, the engineering firm. The entire case of the other side is based upon this. Mr. Rogers responding to Braun's criticisms of the Rogers patent, that it wasn't working out, hires VIR.
Well, we're getting into the merits of the case.
Yes, we are. I'm sorry.
Okay. And my fundamental question is this. Can we speak to the merits of the case? You may be right. You may be wrong. But if our hands are tied, if we have before us an interlocutory appeal, i.e., there was a remittiture order entered, that remittiture has not been accepted or rejected, we cannot accept it or reject it or give you or your adversary in this court that option.
Yes.
Only the district court can.
Yes.
And if that is an interlocutory order, an appeal, and if it isn't, I don't know. I've never seen one that is not. It seems to me that we cannot deal with the caboose, we cannot deal with anything in this entire shooting match unless the case goes back, and if your adversary, first of all, if he accepts the remittiture, he can't appeal, you can appeal. If he does not accept it, neither you nor he can appeal. It has to be retried, and after that trial, they could come up and say that there was error in the remittiture and they want to go back to the original damages that were established. But in order to get to the merits of your argument or their argument, we have to first determine whether or not we have appellate jurisdiction. And as I understand the remittiture practice, and it's not even controversial, we cannot touch it unless the district court first announces and there has been an election made as to whether or not there's going to be a new trial in the district court. For us to speak to the points which you or they raise on appeal is to be strictly an opinion which is without a case, so to speak, that would be the quintessential advisory opinion.
Judge Cowan, I and members of the court, I would draw a distinction between the cross appeal and our appeal. We have a judgment that is a final judgment entered against us that includes the assignment of the 451 panel patent. We are entitled, I believe, to file, and we did, a timely notice of appeal and to have that appeal heard. I do quite agree that the cross appeal, to the extent that the cross appeal is seeking to call into question the remittiture, that is improper, and we have so argued. So we agree, but we do not think that the, if I may call it that, the appeal in chief is thereby non-jurisdictionally proper here. To the contrary, because of the nature of the judgment, we had no choice but to file a notice of appeal and, in fact, to brief the issues and then to determine, obviously, what our response would be to their cross-appeal. They did not have to cross-appeal. So that issue of remittiture would only be here, Your Honor, it is only here by virtue of the cross-appeal. So I think the cross-appeal does, in fact, raise these 1291 final judgment orders and issues, but not ours. Not ours.
But if we spoke to your appeal, to some extent, the points in your appeal are, I don't want to say derivative or corollary, but they are involved inextricably with your adversary's appeal.
Well, Your Honor, in terms of the administration of justice and what makes sense, I will simply say we are here to say the case needs to go back. It needs to go back for a new trial for a variety of reasons, and some of them, from our perspective, are Seventh Amendment. The judgment, in our judgment, should not and cannot properly stand in its present form.
Let me ask the question a different way because I want to make sure I understand your position on it. Assuming that we were to hold that reversal was required because of the remittiture issue, do you view the equitable determinations of the court to be a freestanding issue that would not be subsumed in that order?
We believe the short answer is yes, with an important qualification. We believe that the, quote, equitable determination was, in fact, a violation of the Seventh Amendment. That is, his determination, his adjudication of facts, as opposed to the order itself. We have various arguments under California law, as the court is very familiar with, as to why we think that that is an impermissible remedy, it being the reassignment. But if I may, one of the foundational issues in the case, because this began, of course, is a trade secrets case. And if I may address the merits of that, one of our fundamental points that we would leave the court with today for its consideration is that under the law and under common sense, under Hornbook law, under this court's decisions in IMAX and MAI systems, there is a requirement that the trade secret be identified with particularity with sufficient particularity. This is not an unfair requirement. This is, has nothing to do with the values of notice pleading. It has everything to do with fundamental fairness. And that's what this court was getting at in MAI Systems, which Judge Pragerson served on the panel, as in 1993, and then later in IMAX. And the IMAX case, if I could spend 1 minute of my time on the IMAX case. In IMAX, the IMAX lawyers stand up and say, Your Honor, to Judge Jensen, look at Exhibit U. It is so specific. It refers to dimensions and tolerances in this technology. Technology here is different. Judge Sneed said, that's not enough. You've got to point with particularity. Dimensions and tolerances is simply too generic. Identify it with particularity. And granted summary judgment. It's not a discovery case, as my learned brothers would suggest that it is. It's a summary judgment adjudication. It's a merits adjudication. Why? Because, and then affirmed by a panel of this court on appeal, and that was the end of the case. You needed to identify what? The 6.22 dimension and tolerance. And that is so, as Milgram teaches in the trade secrets hornbook, it is necessary for two vital reasons that go to fundamental fairness. The defendant has to be able to know prior to trial and during trial what it is that is at issue. Here, my brothers on the other side, clearly concerned with the possibility, and we believe likelihood, of a grant of summary judgment against them if they stayed the course, evolving nature of the trade secret at issue. Throughout the litigation, the trade secret definition, which began with particularity in the first amended counterclaim, and we lay this out in the briefs. Phase one cost $15,000. They pointed, Mr. Rogers pointed, to drawing number one and drawing number three. That arguably satisfies the IMAX requirement. But during discovery, during summary judgment, the other side says, that's not the trade secret. We're not limited to that. We're limited only by all of the combinations that can be derived from those five. And we have given the court the calculation. I don't think my brother is going to object to the calculation. That combination gives us at least, or that approach to trade secret definition, gives us at least 33 million combinations.
Are you suggesting, though, that it's almost structural error if the judge does not instruct the jury as to the with particularity on this issue?
No, Your Honor, it is way before.
No, it's not a jury issue. Certainly
a
question of notice, pleading, question of discovery. But now we're at trial. The judge makes statements in chambers that are not helpful and may mislead you. And then the jury gets a proper jury instruction. Why isn't that harmless error?
Well, Your Honor, the jury is not obligated. If I could, on the trade secret, the process and procedure is so vitally important. The trade secret has to be told to us, not to the jury. It's not up to... Okay. Well, if you...
The question is, can you defend the case based on what was disclosed to you?
We could not because of what we have... And, by the way, the trial judge saw fit, and this goes to the definition of trade secret, to not admit evidence of the...
You claim that his definition affected the evidence which he admitted and didn't admit.
With all due respect to Judge Brewster, he got the meaning of trade secret wrong. He said the trade secret can, in fact, be a combination. And we put before him, Your Honor, in the motion in limine. So this is not latter-day inspiration as to error below. In the motion in limine, number 7, we specifically said the other side started out by pointing to Design 1 and Design 3. They've moved from that. If I may say, there's a reason they moved from that. The 451 patent is not Design 1, and it's not Design 3. And their own expert testified to that. They have a powerful and I believe quite dangerous, generative theory. Namely, we can claim very broadly mix and match combinations. What is their case citation for that? They've come up with one case. We've come up with Ninth Circuit law. They've come up with one case from the Northern District of Illinois that they say justifies mix and match. We told the judge in the motion in limine they're trying to mix and match. We can't try that case. It's utterly unfair. We don't know what is at issue if you can mix and match anything and everything. And when one then analyzes their one authority, the Thermodon case, the Thermodyne case involving McDonald's ovens, you see a careful reading of that, the court will discern. The judge, their district judge, not binding on this court, Northern District of Illinois, in fact engaged in an IMAX reasonable particularity kind of analysis. That is so foundational. But if I could just say two other things as my time evaporates. One, there were issues going to, in light of the very important issue of ownership, my brother's claim, undiluted and undefiled ownership in phase one. That was really the theory of their case. Now, in December of 1993, outside the statute of limitations, three-year statute of limitations, outside the statute of limitations, Mr. Rogers returns. This is a telltale. It's just one example of it. I'm not retrying the case. I'm talking about a statute of limitations issue that should have gone to the jury. The jury was not permitted to even take into account whether this was timely or not. We moved for summary judgment on statute of limitations. What was that return check? Recall, Mr. Rogers paid the princely sum of $15,000. That's fine. It was his money. He was eager to move forward. We credit him for that. But then there was an issue, well, who should pay? Who should contribute to that? Braun then, in March of 1993, wrote the check for one half. We refused to pay for the full tab, but we said half is fair. Mr. Rogers held on to the check for 9 months. And then in his testimony at trial, there were issues with respect to Mr. Zimmer's untimely death, his co-inventor. He held onto the check, and that's the reason given to Braun. Well, there are issues with respect to the estate. But in his testimony at trial, he demonstrated the relevance of this issue going to the jury. He said, ownership. We did not want there to be an issue with respect to ownership of phase one. Your Honors, it's undisputed. Braun paid every cent, $266,000, for phase two. It paid for all of phase three. It has paid over $1 million just for the machining. It has worked on the Ultra site, which is a very important in this HIV-infected world. It's a very important device. And the inventors of that device were VIR. And the inventors of that device in phase two, and this was not permitted to go before the jury, the jury didn't get to decide this. We paid the bill. Claude Vidal testified, who is Vidal Engineering, but he's got a terrific group of engineers in Santa Barbara. We credit Rogers for having, yes, this is a good group, and we said, we can work with this group. We can work with this engineering firm. So we enter into what? Purchase orders that they knew about. Mr. Rogers knew about it. He was also present for the interim reports. We paid for it under industry practice. It's ours, not theirs. That's what should have gone to the jury.
Well, yeah, but the question is whether, to what extent did phase one enter, the argument from your adversary is that phase one affected and was part of or in some way.
But, Your Honor, that was not their theory at trial. It's now their theory. They would have you believe, well, it was the designs in phase one. But they lose because their own expert said the 451 is not, in fact, any of the drawings, those five drawings in phase one, and all of those drawings brought together, $15,000, several weeks, publicly known elements, undisputed, publicly known elements. That's when the real work began in phase two, for which Braun paid for. We should have been able to try that before the jury. I thank the court for its attention. I'd like to reserve my 20 seconds.
Very well. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Robert Keyes. I represent
Bobby Rogers and Rossi, we frequently refer to the party as Rogers in this case.
Could you initially address the jurisdiction of this court, this panel, to even hear this case and not just dismiss it?
Yes, Your Honor. Whatever we call it, Judge Brewster was very clear as to what he was doing on the grant of the remitter. Judge Brewster said, if the request was brought pursuant to a motion for new trial, the court may grant the defendant's motion for a new trial or deny the motion conditioned upon the prevailing party's acceptance of a remitter. The court then went on to say, if the request was brought pursuant to a motion for judgment as a matter of law, the court may remit the damages without giving the prevailing party the option of a new trial. The court very specifically denied Braun's motion for a new trial. The court specifically granted Braun's JMOL and reduced the damages. What Judge Brewster essentially did was he said, as a matter of law, that Rogers could not recover unjust enrichment damages, could only recover actual damage, and then calculated what he believed to be the maximum amount of actual damage. That was a legal ruling. It's interesting that along with that ruling, and we've cited his statements in our brief, the court made several, at the very same time he was taking argument on this, several very telling comments when he said that if it's true that a wrongdoer shall not profit from his wrong, then he found that there was substantial evidence supporting the $16 million that were awarded for past damages. He said the evidence was that $16 million was on the lower end of the scale of past damages. Apparently he was troubled, and I'm not sure why, by the provisions of 3426.3, which say in a misappropriation case, the damages are actual damages, unjust enrichment to the extent that they don't duplicate actual damages, and only in a default situation where there is no proof of either of the former, only then is it a royalty. What he did, though, was he wiped out what the jury was given under proper instruction, which was unjust enrichment, and awarded actual damage. He acknowledged that the case of Rogers for damages was largely based on unjust enrichment. I would point out, not entirely. The only evidence of actual damage was that given by Dr. Buckley, who testified to the value of the patent in 1994, which he calculated at $11.6 million, I believe it was, and with interest at the time of trial would have been $21 million.
So I guess your short answer is you think it's a legal conclusion, not a remitter action?
It is a legal conclusion, and he's very specific in his order that that's what he did. He did not offer a new trial. My colleague indicated that Braun had no choice but to appeal. Neither did we. There was no discussion of a new trial.
So your position is he parsed the jury's award of damages and found some was justified and some was not justified under the evidence before the jury. And he made that legal conclusion. That's your argument, as I understand it.
I think it is.
All right. How can he make that? How can he do that given the Seventh Amendment? It's not for the judge to make a legal determination as to what is the appropriate damages for unjust enrichment, for fraud, or for anything else. And if there's a improper jury award because it includes an element which is improper, the judge cannot excise out what the jury picked as the appropriate damages. Either way the argument goes, it seems to me that what he did was trying to cut the baby here and issued what was we've all done many times, remit the damages which he felt were excessive for whatever reason.
Well, I agree with the court that I don't think he can do what he did on the record in front of him. There is no assignment of error in the jury instructions, no assignment of error in the interrogatory sent to the jury, no assignment of error as to the findings of the jury here. There is no claim that any Braun requested jury instruction was not given. There is no claim that any special interrogatory to the jury requested by Braun was denied.
Well, the claim is more fundamental. The claim is that they were never put on notice as to what the trade secret was, that you had an IMAX, you had whatever million-dollar combinations, and that number one, phase one had no trade secrets in it. It had nothing that wasn't already in the public domain, that was in the prior art, and that the ultimate invention could not possibly be inclusive of any trade secret because phase one had no trade secret, and they were never, and the jury was never told what the trades, what the combination is of phase one, which was the secret, which is to be protected from being filched on. That's their argument, as I understand.
That is their argument, I heard it at length in the trial. What's wrong with that is, first of all, IMAX is a case that that deals with a discovery statute in California. In IMAX, they went through four or five or six successive attempts to get the plaintiff to state the nature of the trade secret. In IMAX, there was a patent, and the plaintiff had done improvements on that patent by way of certain specific dimensions that would be applied to the device that was described. But he apparently wouldn't tell the other side what those dimensions were.
And
the
why
dimensions,
is that different from this case?
I'm sorry?
Why is that different from this case? You had a very loose definition. Go ahead.
If I may differ, we had a very tight definition. It was 16 pages. It was the phase one report with drawings, each of which was testified to be a unique drawing, each of which was established to be a trade secret. It was not known in the industry, and it had economic value, and it met the definition of 3426.
Is that a little general? I mean, it seems to me your brief doesn't say what the secret is of those of phase one and its development into further phases. Even on appeal, you're not saying what the actual trade secret is.
The trade secret is the report. It is the diagrams along with the heading. For example, type one. It states some of the features as engineering drawings do, because such as three-part assembly, debugging may be necessary, but it is a diagram, an engineering concept drawing.
Well, a diagram can't be a trade secret unless it has something which is unique, it's not known, it's...
It is. And the testimony from Professor Antonsen, our expert, the testimony from Mr. Sheehan, their expert, was that none of these diagrams were known in the prior art. Judge Brewster dealt with this at length in hearings, that the trade secret, even though it may be composed of building blocks known in the industry, the particular combination, the case law is in concurrence, the trade secret is in the combination of those building blocks, just as the words of a book are all in the dictionary, but the book isn't. It's how they're put together.
And what is the combination of this that makes it a trade, a particular combination
The five types contained in the phase one report.
Well, you can't take a dictionary and say, we claim all the words in the dictionary, and therefore you can't write a copyrighted piece.
Correct.
They have a right to know what combination you're litigating and what the trade secret is. And The district court asked you directly, and you gave a generic answer. Your briefs give a generic answer. It's difficult to say, looking at the trial, what the precise trade secret was that they took. Now, if you're trying to claim a trade secret protection of all the building blocks, and I think that goes far beyond what we've allowed or anybody's allowed as being protected.
Let me be very clear. We are not claiming trade secret in the building blocks. We did not claim it at trial. We are claiming the concept drawings created by the VIR engineers that are contained in the Phase 1 report. Two things I should say, because the mix and match
combination concept. What combination of the drawings are you claiming that constituted a trade secret? I mean, once you get beyond the drawings, then you're into a combination and mix and match, and we don't know what you're talking about, really.
Well, we're not into combinations of mix and match, and maybe I could address that for a moment. The types listed in Phase 1 could be mixed and matched is merely an attribute of the types. At no time did we or the court say that there was a sixth or a seventh or an eighth or a 2 millionth combination on which we claim a trade secret. At no time was that ever done. If someone came with diagrams of three concept vehicles, they all have tires, wheels, transmissions, and so forth. An attribute of those, that they presented it to GM, might be that the transmission from type 2 also fits in type 1. They're not claiming a new type 4, but merely describing an attribute. That's all that was ever done here, was that an attribute of these diagrams is that certain of the elements can be mixed and matched. But we should also be very, very clear. That was never mentioned to the jury, either in jury instructions or in argument of counsel, nor was it in the jury verdict form. The jury verdict form was very specific. Do you find trade secrets in Phase 1?
Well, let me see if I can understand. Maybe I'm not understanding your answer. If I understand your position, you aren't claiming trade secrets in the building blocks themselves.
No, we are not.
You're claiming a trade secret in the combination, but you didn't argue what that combination was, right?
No, we did.
So what did you just say to me when you said we didn't argue ever, at any time what the combination was?
We argued the combinations are type 1. That is a combination of tires, wheels, and whatever. That is a combination of, and the experts testified how many there were. There may have been 15, there may have been 20 separate building blocks. But type 1 is a trade secret. Type 2 is a trade secret. A separate, distinct concept drawing. Type 3 is a trade secret. And the experts, both of them, were questioned at length as to the progression, in this case, from type 1 to the ultrasite. The jury was asked, there's a complicating factor here in that the VIR engineers were present throughout this. If Braun had stolen in the middle of the night into the VIR offices, broken in, entered, and stole this report and took it back to their engineers and based their further development on the trade secrets contained in the diagrams, in the concepts that were prepared through Rogers by VIR, we'd still have the same claim we have today. What in fact they did was they stole it in a different fashion. And in addition, they stole the consultants of Rogers to bring it to fruition. But we still go back to the trade secret. The court instructed the jury that its verdict had to take into account the degree to which phase one, in this case, the type one, the drawing, contributed to the patent. And the jury's verdict found that it was substantial, the only inference that can be drawn from the $16 million award. The court concurred. But there's a very specific statement of what the trade secret is. It's physical and it's placed in front of them. Unlike IMAX, where in IMAX, the trade secret was dimensions and tolerances, and they never said, here it is, this dimension from here to here of 0.16 millimeters or whatever it might be. They never said that.
Well, in this case, where is it said as to what combination or reshuffling of the data is the trade secret?
No combination of this is the trade secret. It is the trade secret in and of itself.
And your position is because it wasn't in the prior art, because it's not in general knowledge, that the further development of that entitles you of your property, phase one, entitles you to the verdict?
For two reasons. If we take type one, this is a unique combination not known in the art and was presented as a trade secret. Now,
your testimony is that it was not known in the prior art.
It was not, and it isn't mine. It was Dr. Antonsen and Mr. Sheehan. There was no contradictory evidence. It was not known in the prior art. The building blocks are not, this is not one of the building blocks. This is composed of 20 building blocks put together in a unique fashion. A piston, for example, is one of the elements in any of these valves. That is one of the building blocks, and other devices had pistons. Other devices had walls. Other devices had springs. Other devices had ports and openings. Those are the building blocks. This is not a building block. This is the trade secret. And this is the trade secret that was presented to the jury. This is what the jury found very specifically was the trade secret. And actually, in four of the jury interrogatories, the court was very careful.
They're arguing that they were not aware of the specific trade secrets involved, and that you could take those numbers and with a mathematician and come to, what, a million or so combinations.
We did not claim a million combinations or any others. It's interesting that the appellants say that now. But under the California discovery statutes, they say discovery shouldn't even begin, Ron, if you don't know what the trade secret being claimed is. They began discovery without objection. During discovery, they never said, neither we nor they can proceed with this discovery to the court because they haven't met the gatekeeper role of establishing what the trade secret is. They didn't do that. They went for 5 years in this litigation without doing that. Today they say they don't know what the trade secret is, but they had no problem, none whatsoever, doing discovery on phase one. Most of the discovery was directed at phase one.
Sure, but you have to show what part of the phase one or attributes were actually incorporated in the patent 451, right?
There was extensive testimony from Dr. Antonsen and Mr. Sheehan on that issue.
Well, let me answer. Just to back up, the lowering of the jury award from what, 16 to 5?
Correct.
What was the $11 million that was taken away from you? That was for what?
Unjust enrichment.
Claiming that, as the district court thought that the $11 million for unjust enrichment was not within the evidence that was presented?
No. No. In fact, he stated to the opposite, if I may.
I thought that was the the heart of your case, that they had made all this money off of your trade secret, and therefore you were entitled to this money.
It was at the heart of our case. The court said, in ruling on motions, if it is true that unjust enrichment as a matter of law is any profit made from the wrongful conduct, then it seems to me the verdict on compensatory damages portion is supported by substantial evidence.
Well, if that was his ruling, then how could he take $11 million off the...
Because what he did in essence was say, was negate the UTSA. He said, Rogers, you can't get unjust enrichment. I will only allow you to recover actual damage. That's where the error in law occurs in what Judge Brewster did. The fact is that the UTSA specifically authorizes unjust enrichment, and the case law is replete, California as well as national.
Well, he remitted the $11 million, but your testimony was substantially more, that you were entitled to a substantially more than $11 million for unjust enrichment.
Our testimony as presented was that Ron said their past profits were $11 or $12 million. Our evidence was that they were, with interest, $23
million. Yeah.
That's the basis for the $16 million award, which is pretty much smack dab in the middle of what the two sides presented as actual damage.
Yeah, but the district judge had no way of knowing where the jury came up with the $11 million. They could have gone for the entire figure that you claim they made, and they could have gone for the lesser figure that Braun said they the judge just cut it out $11 million. Well, a function which is clearly a jury function, not a judge function.
I agree, Your Honor.
And I don't like to harp on the remitter thing, but it seems to me he cut the compensatory damages, which the jury had awarded, finding for whatever reason that it was, he allowed the $5 million to stay for unjust enrichment.
No.
For
actual damage. And he stated in his ruling,
actual damage that you suffered.
That $5 million was his estimate of actual damage.
Okay. But you claim you had a lot more than $5 million of damage. And there's a question, certainly, as to whether or not you had any damage at all from your adversary's point of view.
Well, the patent is a valuable thing. I don't think my adversary contests the value of this patent.
No, but he claims that you didn't prove that you had any actual damage. He's not harping so much on the unjust enrichment because they have to acknowledge they made money off of the patent. But he is claiming that there's nothing in this record that reflects that even if you agree that you were defrauded, that you suffered any actual damage by reason of that fraud.
We didn't have an ongoing production yet. We couldn't. This was a new product. So did we lose sales that we otherwise can prove we would have had? No. We did prove that we had the capability to market this to other people.
Why is that enough? You know, we had a case years ago, St. Paul versus American Bank, where we said in a fraud case, the question was detrimental reliance, that it's not enough to show you had the capability. You had to show that you had actually, there was a market, you would have actually succeeded. That you have to put on that kind of evidence. Here it looks to me as though the only evidence of detrimental reliance is the fact that there was reliance. You didn't show you were going to market or could market or there was a market. That evidence seems to be lacking.
There was...
And in the other case, the evidence was pretty strong that there was, in that particular case, a market.
There was strong evidence here that there was a market. Braun was willing to pay $1.6 million on the 114, which was a totally untested device in which everyone knew needed substantial further development. Braun's own analysis, Eileen Brobst-Lane, we cited in our brief, said upon seeing the 114 that it had a potential $65 million present value. The number of valves that have been sold, the gross revenues, the net profit of Braun from precisely what was stolen, the 451 patent,
I'm talking about the damages attributable to fraud that one can segregate from your other general damages. And the figure of $1 million seems to be pulled out of the thin air. It looks like a punitive damage award rather than a compensatory damage award for fraud.
My apologies. I didn't realize, I didn't understand the court's question.
I was probably unclear in the
way. As to the fraud damages?
Yes. You can't explain the million on the basis of the evidence, can you?
Yes, I can.
All right.
The 114 in 1992 had a value of $1.6 million to Braun. That a fortiori, they entered into the license agreement and they were willing to pay that amount for it without even making an attempt to develop it. And that for only a license that would be cancelable. In 1994, when the reliance takes place, because by that point in time, Rogers had the right to terminate the 114, but he was told that Braun was continuing to develop it. There's no reason to believe that the value of that 114 had in any way diminished, particularly since all Braun bought was a license for 1.6. Rogers had the right even to sell the 114, much less develop it. There was a market out there. Eileen Brooks Lane testified, and Ken Raines, the chief engineer for Braun, testified by way of letter that there was a strong market, that the market was seeking needle-free capless back-check valves.
I don't even think Braun is not claiming there wasn't a market out there. It's a market they were playing in, too. The question is, did you have some actuary or some damage expert show what, by reason of the alleged fraud, you were prevented from realizing a profit on?
We did not have an expert address that specific issue.
Well, that's an issue you must prove if you're going to recover money for a fraud count.
Those damages can be determined by the jury based upon the value of the 114, and Braun itself set the parameters of those values by what they were willing to pay in 1992 for a license.
Was the jury instructed that they could find the damages on that count based on that scenario?
That would be a more specific instruction than a court would normally give, I believe.
The court gives a fraud instructions. We've all done it dozens of times, and you go through the fraud, the elements of a fraud count and fraud, representation, reasonable reliance, and damages.
Correct.
There's no damages proved here on this fraud count as far as the briefing is concerned.
That Rogers did not attempt to further market the 114 because Rogers was told the 114 was being developed by Braun.
But this is what you get into. It's a different scenario, but that's the problem with the American Bank and other cases, that a decision not to market isn't enough to sustain that, I don't believe. You have to show what the market is and what it's worth.
But we did. I think there was substantial evidence from the Braun personnel themselves as to what the market was, and as to the value of this particular device in the market.
And extrapolating their profits from that, and someone extrapolated their profits which they could have made from this the device.
Well, once it's established that there is damage, it is not incumbent on a party to prove the precise amount of the damage.
I agree with that, but they got to prove that there were damages. They've got to have some. The jury can't pick out of thin air what the damages are because there's a market out there. They've got to have someone lead them to what the reasonable market would have realized for them. Let me ask you, just to backpaddle on this a little bit. If then, of the $16 million original verdict, it was lowered to $5 million. $5 million, you say, represents unjust enrichment or rather the fraud damages?
No. No, what the court stated in his opinion was the $5 million is his estimate of actual damage for the misappropriation.
That would be actual damage which you sustained by reason of the fraud.
Of the misappropriation.
Of the misappropriation. Okay. So that's the – but then the – what in effect the judge did was he substituted his idea of what the unjust enrichment of Braun was for what the jury determined it to be.
I think he did.
How can he do that?
He can't, and that's why we think the remitter must be vacated.
Well, if we're dealing with a remitter, we can't be talking about the merits of this case, which you and your adversary have very ably addressed to us.
Maybe I can use a different term. That's why we think the order of the court that resulted in a remittance of damages must be vacated. The court had no authority to make the order that it did. It did not purport.
But then the remedy is that we, if that's all true, if it's not just an error of law, not just a typical JMOL, if in fact it was a true remitter, then your remedy is you get a new trial.
If it was a true remitter.
And if you get a new trial, then you don't save the parts you like.
But it was not. But it was not a true remitter. By his own words, very specifically, motion for new trial denied. After saying
the practical effect is this, though, if you're making a true error of law, saying there was no evidence on this point, and I'm reducing the verdict because of this, but your argument is different. Your argument is no, he was just estimating the damage, and substituting his own factual findings for the jury and reducing the award to that on based on an estimate, and if that's true, then we're probably into remitter land, if you will, as opposed to a question of a true JMOL.
He didn't substitute his knowledge for that of the jury. What he said in two separate instances was, if a wrongdoer cannot profit by his wrong, then $16 million is supported by substantial evidence. What he did say was essentially that he finds that Rogers can't recover unjust enrichment. I will award him actual damage. He said, as a matter of law, he can't recover for unjust enrichment. Now, I don't know where that came from, but that is what he said. That is the error. Rogers can recover for unjust enrichment. There was no objection to the instructions. They were properly given. There is none here today. The jury properly performed its function. There's no reason to believe otherwise. What he can't do is vacate the jury's unjust enrichment award by saying that that they can't award it.
All right, let me ask this a hypothetical, and I won't hold it against you. Matter of fact, I won't tell a person in this world about this. If you were given
it will
the option
be available as a digital
taking
audio,
19, of taking the $5 million or retrying the case, I take it you would want to retry the case. Or if you don't want to answer, you don't have to.
I would have to consult with my client to commit to that.
That's a good answer.
Go ahead.
Take it one step further. If you were to not accept the $5 million, say, look, I want the $16 million, you could try the case again. And if you get less than $16 million on the next appeal, you could then claim that the remitter was in error, and you want the original jury award reinstated. But I'm really at sea as to how we can deal with with this case, where number one, you have no damages for the actual loss which you sustained, and the judge appears to me to have said $16 million for unjust enrichment is, for whatever reason, inappropriate. I'm going to lower it to $5
million. Again, I think it's important that I correct that. He didn't say that $16 million is not a good number for unjust enrichment. In fact, he said the opposite. He said there is substantial evidence for the figure of unjust enrichment, and he said if the standard he is to follow that a wrongdoer should not profit from his wrong, then he had no complaint with the $16 million. He just didn't buy that standard. He threw out the unjust enrichment and replaced it with his estimate of actual damage.
So there's no evidence of damages for actual loss that he could, as far as the briefs are concerned.
There actually is evidence.
To the point where he substitutes his estimate of damages, and that's what he's doing, what a jury should be doing. And if he's, that makes it, appears to be just a true remitter.
No, I don't think so. He didn't fault the jury or find that the jury was excessive.
What would be the big problem with a new trial?
Because this patent was issued in 1995. Rogers and Rossi, that gives Rogers and Rossi the right to use it if they own it until 2012. We're already in 2005. They have waited 10 years to try to get their rights confirmed in this patent. We could be back here 4 years from now.
Why did it take so long?
It took so long because, first of all, because of the concealment of Braun, of they're applying for a patent such that the first legal effort was made shortly after Mr. Rogers found out about it in late 97. The complaint was filed February of 98. At that point, we're under the control of the court, and we follow the court's schedule, and trial occurred in 2003. Now we're here in 2005.
So it took 5 years to get a case to trial?
It did.
Let me ask this. And we have, of course, that conference. I don't know what the panel will decide in this case, but assume we decide that this is a remitter by any name. Assume that. What is your position concerning your adversary's response to that assumption? That's fine for your case, but as far as they're concerned, their case, the patent reassignment and so forth, that's not a dog. Their dog is not in that fight.
I believe that the other findings made by the jury, legitimately made by the jury, that should be affirmed. I don't want it going back. If it did go back, I think it should go back on the issue of damages only.
Why should it go back on the whole shooting match? Not only your countersuit, but their original suit. If this is a true remitted, if it is a remitter.
Because if I. I think I've gotten myself confused by Your Honor's questions. I'm trying to sort through it.
Let's not use the word jurisdiction because, in fact, we probably do have jurisdiction over the primary appeal, but there's a good argument that it makes the judge's second, what we'll call the equitable proceeding, because that's what he did in this case. Perhaps it should have been something else, but it may make that moot because it was predicated on his post-trial, the ruling on the post-trial motion. So if the remediator, if it's a true remediator, you've got to make a choice and you go back for a new trial. It doesn't make much sense that the independent patent reassignment would stand.
I would think in the interest of judicial economy and in the interest of justice that the other findings that are appropriately made should stand, and the remediator should go only to the issue of damages.
So let's talk briefly. I know we're way over time, but before you sit down, I wanted to ask you about the patent reassignment. I just it's hard for me to see how California statutes permit that remedy. I don't see any case that really supports it outside the language in the Federal Circuit, which predates the statute. Our cases pretty clearly indicate that the common law remedies pre-statute don't survive. What's your best argument on that?
Unfortunately, I have about three. It was Braun that asked this court to determine ownership of the patent. It was the court's charge, both under the complaint and the cross-complaint, to determine who owned the patent. The court made that determination, who has all right, title, and interest in the patent. The UTSA does not preempt other remedies or other causes of action not based on misappropriation. It does not supplant common law remedies. And the cases are multiple, not only throughout the nation, but in California as well, regarding patent reassignment. The Pendleton case, the is a directly on point. Civil Code sections 2223 and 2224.
Even assuming that there is a remedy of reassignment, assume for the purpose of argument.
Yes.
You put $15,000 into this show. They put a heck of a lot more money into it. How does the district court reasonably conclude that you're entitled to 100% of the patent on a reassignment when they, you know, it's got to be, they've got to be entitled to something here.
The district court goes through an analysis in its findings of fact under the license agreement.
But Ron
cannot convert proprietary information of Rogers by fraud or concealment or in any other fashion. They can only do it by the authority of Rogers. They cannot take VIR as their representatives.
So why isn't a damage remedy adequate?
Because Rogers owns the patent. He owns the intellectual property that led to the patent. It was Rogers' consultants, and that's the word, not agent, that he uses in his findings of fact, that VIR at all times remained the consultant to Rogers. VIR was the repository of Rogers' confidential proprietary information. Braun, under the contract, was not allowed to take that to its own use, and they did. Everything that VIR developed rightly belonged to Rogers according to the findings of fact made by the court below. So they own the patent. A wrongdoer can't take possession of a property that doesn't belong to him by theft, by misappropriation, or by fraud. And that's fundamental in the law, whether it be a house, a car, or in this case, intellectual property. We can't condone the acts of that wrongdoer. In fact, that would make Braun's plan, as put forth in 1995 when they had their meeting and decided to do all this, that would justify what they did. Why not? Why offer it to Rogers? All he'll get is a royalty anyway. Well, that's not the law, and hopefully never will be, that a thief takes title to the stolen property if he's successful enough at it. He never takes title. And the court is not powerless to turn it back. There's an issue on our cross-appeal we haven't touched on. If I may have just 2 minutes, perhaps the court doesn't care to hear it. The license agreement was sua sponte, pulled from nowhere. It was never pled. It was never even requested by Braun. It came out and it eviscerated every property right that Rogers has. It totally negated the transfer, and it's not authorized under California statute, federal statute, common law, or the UTSA. The license agreement, the order for the license agreement should be reversed.
All right. I'm giving you an extra 23 minutes and some odd seconds.
I had it more than that. I thank the court for its generosity.
Okay.
I'll be very brief. I have to be. First, on damages, we guide the court to excerpts
of... We're not going to limit... Oh,
thank you.
Seconds,
so. I'll try not to abuse your kindness.
We're also a court of equity.
I'm very grateful. I'll speak a little bit more slowly, but I'll try not to burden the court. We guide the court to excerpts of record, page 852, where the judge specifically found, this goes to the damages issue and what was going on here, quote, and this is in our brief, the court finds that the jury improperly sought
to punish Braun through the compensatory damages award, so we're talking about misappropriation, not fraud, based on profits, improperly sought to punish. Our brothers on the other side chose not to even address this point in their reply brief. We put it before the court that there needs to be a new trial for a variety of reasons, but here is another one. As to remediature, I believe the court's questions suggest that the appropriate approach by the judiciary on review is to examine what the court below actually did. And as we said before, and I don't think that I've heard a response to this particular point, that the judge, Judge Brewster, actually engaged in a weighing. What my brother refers to as to the $16 million is justified is a much earlier reflection on the record. It is not to be found in that order that grants what we believe was remediature and functionally is a remediature. And again, he uses even the words remit. He said specifically in his argument, my brother Keyes, that the judge, quote, calculated what he believed was correct. I quote Mr. Keyes, very able lawyer, said to this court, the judge Brewster calculated what he believed to be the correct. That's classic remediature language. Point two. Much has been said about this document, phase one. Mr. Rogers, through his able trial counsel, had the opportunity to stand on this. One reviews the record and sees that's not what was done. The evolving theory of the trade secret evolved and was transformed into mix and match. Mix and match was what was argued at summary judgment. We said that's wrong, that violates IMAX. We moved in limine, specifically and expressly invoking the principle, which is the key, but the principle embodied in IMAX. Their theory at trial was mix and match, and there's a very good reason that they needed to mix and match. He held up figure one or drawing one is not the 451 patent. There are elements in any valve. If you bring a valve in the medical device, it will have elements. What is undisputed is that every one of these elements or building blocks was in the public domain. And Judge Cowan's point about this process, and we honor the process, but it was a very limited process of $15,000. And then the language about thievery, I beg to disagree in light of the fact that it's undisputed that with Mr. Rogers' knowledge, he was quite content to see the relationship with VIR move to Braun in terms of he was delighted for Braun to pick up the tab. That's the point. And in this industry, if a consultant, not agent, if a consultant, although the judge bought into an agency theory, which is a jury issue, a Seventh Amendment issue, but if the consultant is working for Braun and Braun is paying the tab, that explains why the assignment of the patent rights by the four engineers in Santa Barbara, not in San Diego, not Mr. Rogers, but the four engineers in Santa Barbara working for VIR, and then Claude Vidal himself said, uncontradicted testimony, my client became Braun.
What is your response to their position that, look, you went to discovery, the jury, and you never said to the judge, let's stop the music. We want to know with particularity and specificity what the trade secret is that they claim we misappropriated.
Your Honor, it was so clear. I referred earlier to our motion in limine number 7.
In limine, okay.
So that's before trial. Now, that's when we saw this evolving theory.
But you wanted to discuss, and that was denied.
It was denied. We said IMAX. They are evolving the theory. They are moving to mix and match. Mix and match cannot be done under the law, Your Honor. And the judge denied our motion. Now, that was pre-trial. But what had happened is, and again, we see the shifting occurred even here today. Now we're back to phase one and no mixing and matching. But that was not what was argued before the jury.
How about objection to the charge to the jury? You didn't specifically say we object because there's no specificity as to what the trade secret is that we incorporated into 451.
It was utterly fruitless. We did have, in fact, other jury instructions that had been proposed. But, Your Honor, there were long colloquies with Judge Brewster on this, and this was invited error. My learned brother on the other side said, I do not have to stand on phase one. I do not have to stand on drawings one and three. I get to mix and match. He needed, as he saw it, I think, to mix and match to get to the 451, which had elements that VIR developed in phase two that Braun paid for. Our point is, that's a jury issue. I don't want to convince you here, to convince you here today that the interrelationship, and I have one final point, is something that you can decide as a matter of law. Our submission is it was a jury issue. And when my brother speaks of the judge found this and the judge found that, we invite the court to findings 47 through 52, which is the judge's findings of fact at the conclusion of what he called the caboose trial. That's not disrespectful. That's what Judge Brewster called it. This is our caboose trial. Where was the jury? The jury had gone. And he then proceeds to make these findings with no citation to the record. And there's a reason for that. We've tried to be respectful in our brief, but we've been firm. Zero support for the idea that during phase two, the critical phase that we were paying for, that there was, in fact, a relationship with R&R. Now, if they thought that there was, or that we had somehow violated the contract, why did they not bring an action in contract? They instead brought an action on misappropriation.
What is your response to their position is that 451 and all the other phases after phase one are just a natural progression and lineage and evolution of the original phase one, which they paid for?
But it again ignores exactly what two phases. It ignores what phase one is. Phase one, and he is now trumpeting phase one, is a sketch done in 4 weeks, 3 weeks, that combines elements that are all in the public domain. And then that begins a process.
The claim is that both experts claim that it was not in the public domain, that it was your expert and his expert said it was.
The drawing itself, I'm drawing a distinction between the elements and the combination. Your Honor, if he had stuck with drawing number one in phase one is our trade secret, I don't think we would have an IMAX. It would be a very different IMAX. I don't want to definitively argue because he didn't. He chose a mix and match kind of theory. So he has a definitional problem, for starters. It still brings us back to what is phase one and then what is phase two. And the fact that phase two is where the intellectual work was done that generated then the 451 and that we paid for it, and he's speaking about theft, is very, very odd when that cost $266,000 and then well over, and all this is undisputed. So we think, with all due respect, that phase one, that the trial, that the court, and I will conclude with this subject to the court's questions. This court can conclude, as a matter of law, that they lose. As a matter of law, because they fail to identify the trade secret with sufficient particularity, IMAX controls, and IMAX is grounded in the structure of the statute. It could also conclude as a matter of law that the assignment is utterly impermissible, and I heard my brother's answer. I did not hear him citing to principles of California law, certainly not the Uniform Trade Secrets. He chose to bring a trade secrets case and not an assignment case and a contract case. Had he brought that, perhaps assignment, depending on the evidence, would be a permissible remedy. But he did not. He chose to bring a trade secrets case. Our final point is, so many of these issues should have gone to the jury. And the Seventh Amendment jury trial is foundational to our submission here today. I thank the Court for its attention.
Thank you.